Our second case this morning is case numbers 093714, 093923, and 101060. Opp versus Cook County State's Attorney's Office. Ms. Bogart.
May it please the court, my name is Susan Bogart. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Kahneman. I also am joined by Mr. Holman, who is representing Ms. Opp and Ms. Barrett. The district court's decision to dismiss the Mr. Kahneman's complaint with prejudice should be reversed for what I can determine is at least five reasons. The district court's interpretation of the exemption under the ADEA is overly broad and inconsistent with the plain language of that statute and that exemption. The district court's interpretation is inconsistent with...
I don't want to interrupt you in mid-flight, but doesn't the assistant state's attorney have the authority of the state's attorney when he's in court?
The assistant state's attorney has that authority that is delegated to them to implement actions on behalf of the state's attorney.
You mean the state's attorney sets policy, but the individual assistant state's attorney in the courtroom is acting on behalf of the state's attorney. What he does is binding on the state's attorney. That is, if an assistant enters a motion to nolly prosecute case, that's the end of that.
We would suggest, Judge, that if it's inconsistent with the state's attorney's policy...
You mean he can't do it in open court?
He cannot set policy.
If he dismisses the case in open court, the judge doesn't have to permit it?
If it's beyond the authority and the permission of...
The authority is the authority granted by the state's attorney, which is the authority to conduct the case, isn't it?
The authority is the authority of the policy of the office of the state's attorney.
I know, but the implementation of that policy is the assistant state's attorney's program, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
So he acts at that stage of the game as the state's attorney. And he's addressed the state's attorney.
His actions in implementing the state's attorney's policy would be a
He might get fired as a result of doing something like that. But what he does is final, isn't it?
What he does on behalf of the state's attorney...
What he does in courtroom on behalf of the government.
Yes. Is if
final.
It's
done.
Is not setting policy. It's implementing.
I know.
All right.
But he might get fired for not implementing, but if he disagrees with the policy and proceeds to do whatever he feels like doing, it's still done. It's over.
Well, that may be the case, Judge.
Well, no, it is the case. Not maybe.
Can you
think of anything that the government can do about it after it's done? A jury hears him say, for instance, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I think you ought to find him not guilty, and walks out. Now, that may be a violation of his direction and everything else, but it's over then.
Well, insofar as a not guilty determination by an assistant state's attorney in a criminal case, I would agree with you. But I don't know that
Once you establish that, you've established the fact that he can act for the state's attorney, and therefore he can act independently and that's why the state's attorney has the right to fire him, because if he does something bad, he can can him.
He can implement the state's attorney and the policy of the state's attorney's office. One of the bases to reverse the district court's interpretation of the exemption, because it is an overly broad interpretation of the statutory and congressional intent that it be narrowly construed. The district court's dismissal of Kahneman's complaint is inconsistent with this court's decisions on the issue of a policymaker, which requires
has
that there be...
Has this court ever said an assistant state's attorney is not a policymaker?
I am not aware of this court's making that statement. I am aware of this court analyzing cases in the policymaker area, which involves the First Amendment and the under the Section 1983, which it looks to when it analyzes...
So your answer to my question is no. This court has never taken a position that assistant state's attorney is not a policymaker.
I'm not aware of that position.
Neither
no.
am I. So
okay.
We stand in pretty good
But I would suggest, Judge, under the Seventh Circuit's precedent in Waters, in the Arupolis case, and in the Vargas case, that this court has directed that factual analyses occur in order to assess whether the individual at issue, particularly in a public office, should fall into a higher level office, which would be consistent with the exemption, or a lower level office requires a factual determination if they are one who sets policy versus one who merely implements.
So the first assistant would be exempt, but nobody else.
Well, I can't say nobody else, but I do believe
Chief
the first assistant.
Division.
I do believe the first assistant would likely fall into the category that's exempted under the ADA.
Chief of criminal, chief of civil.
I believe that's true.
Oh, okay. How about if we get into here? We've got 900. What if we've got a county that has 50? ASAs.
It's hard to speculate, Judge. We have no facts on the record
Excuse me? Or 10 ASAs. Wouldn't they all be pretty closely working with the elected state's attorney?
That could be the case, and they also may fall into a separate exemption under the Age Discrimination Act because of the size of the office. But what we are looking at strictly here is the exemption insofar as the definition of employee.
Ms. Bogart, do I understand from your briefs that you think we ought to apply two different lines to First Amendment political affiliation claims and ADEA and Title VII claims? Is there an intermediate group that would be protected under Title VII and the ADEA but would not be protected under the First Amendment under your analysis?
I think that's a possibility. The statutory intent for Title VII and the ADEA is a question of federal law. The analysis for First Amendment purposes and political patronage cases is slightly different. I think the ADEA and Title VII's exemption clearly contemplates that there will be political appointees in the highest level of the cabinet offices, and so does the congressional intent. That those are the individuals they perceive should be exempted from the ADA or Title VII.
I thought this Court's decisions made it pretty clear that we drew that line the same for First Amendment, Title VII, ADEA purposes.
In the analysis of the policymaker, It is our position that the district court's dismissal was inconsistent with these court's decisions.
Are you inviting us, though, to draw a distinction so that somebody in the state's attorney's position, for example, would have to categorize people not just above or below one line, but add a second line in there for different, and how would we determine who's covered and who's not?
I don't know that I'm talking about bright lines here, but I do think there's a factual basis could be made to say that this is a person who falls into the setting of the policy versus the mere implementation of the policy, and it would be consistent with this Court's policymaker analysis under the First Amendment as well as the exemption under the ADEA.
Would it be appropriate for a federal court to issue an injunction ordering a state's attorney to rehire a particular person as an assistant with the legal authority to speak on behalf of the office?
This
person must be your lawyer.
Well, I don't know that that would be the case.
Isn't that some of the relief that you want?
Do your clients want
to be rehired?
Well, I think the relief that we're seeking in the equitable side is certainly a reinstatement of anybody that was discriminated against based on age. Yes.
So a federal injunction saying this person must be the lawyer for the state.
Equitable relief to reinstate if there's a violation of the federal law, yes. And I should add, in this case, the state's attorney has consented to the anti-discrimination statutes and holds himself out as actually complying with them on the age as well as other.
The individual feelings of a particular state's attorney, that affect the outcome of this case. Why would I care what any individual state's attorney wants to do with his or her assistants? If she wants to describe it as it's locked in forever, it doesn't make any difference.
I think that they are at will, and they can be fired at will as any other employee, but not if it violates the anti-discrimination laws, if they fall into a category that's not in the exemption. And I believe all my time is up.
Mr. Holman.
Good morning, Brian Holman, on behalf of Christine Abt and Edward Barrett, two former assistant state's attorneys that we allege were terminated because of their age. The district court, after they determined that they had to use the political firing framework, which allowed them to look at the positions of assistant state's attorney in a whole as to their inherent powers instead of taking individually whether Christine Abt and Edward Barrett actually had policy-making authority.
The job office itself is what causes the apparent authority. When you hire an assistant state's attorney, he acts on behalf of the state's attorney. He is, in effect, hiring somebody to represent the government in his name.
Yes, and pursuant to the district court relied on the Illinois statute, 55 ILCS 5-4-203, to make the conclusion that they had the same powers as the state's attorney. But if you review that statute does not indicate that. In fact, the statute indicates that they're under the supervision of the state's attorney, which is the very language of the statute that the district court...
You mean, say, when you hire somebody, you tell them you're hired as long as you do what I tell you to do. But that doesn't mean that he can't bind the state of Illinois or the state's attorney himself when he does something, which may or may not be contrary to policy that's established by the front.
But with all due respect, Your Honor, what an assistant state's attorney does in a courtroom on behalf of the state's attorney does not put that person on a policy-making level.
Why not? If he decides whether or not he's going to proceed or offer a particular piece of evidence, he's doing exactly that.
Because a policy-making level individual is someone who dictates the conduct of the government.
No, it dictates what we're going to do. It's a position I occupied in both areas, both state's attorney and assistant state's attorney and U.S. attorney as well. And I set policy only in the general sense. The specifics in the courtroom I left to the assistant because I had to. Otherwise, I could pop around to each courtroom. I wouldn't need any assistance. But they were acting for me. They wore my name on the sleeve, but they were acting for the government, and they did it. And they bound the government just as they bound me.
I think we can still take Your Honor's position that an assistant state's attorney is a policymaker. Is that person still on a policy-making level pursuant to what the drafters' intent was when they created the exemption?
I don't know precisely that, but I do know that when he acts with authority of the state, he's acting in that capacity, and he can be fired because for any reason or no reason.
Is he acting on that based on what? On the Illinois statute or based on...
Based on the job itself. The Illinois statute and our laws, which say that policymakers are not covered by this. You can fire a policymaker whenever you want, if you're the boss, if you're elected. That's why we elect him. We don't elect him and then bind him and say you have to keep... Once you hire somebody, you've got to keep.
But under that belief, Your Honor...
Yes.
And under the Sidley and Austin case, where they talked about taking in the private sector, an associate acting on behalf of a partner in a courtroom...
Different ball game altogether. Different ball game altogether. They're not responsible to the public at large. They don't have to run for election. They don't have to hold things out. State's attorney is unique, like all executive officers are unique. That's why. But I didn't expect you to agree with me. I just wanted you to know where I was coming from and to see whether you could change my mind.
Well, let me change your mind this way, Your Honor. What the district court relied on was the Illinois statute. And in order to do that, the statute has to be unambiguous. And the Illinois statute that they rely on is not. It doesn't give the powers of the state's attorney to the assistant state's attorney in the global sense that Your Honor is referring to. And again, does that make, if the assistant state's attorney has the authority to walk in on behalf of the state's attorney in the courtroom, does that mean that they're on a policy level, policy-making
level?
Well,
if you think of what they're doing in a courtroom, you might think of a great Greek phrase. That which is obvious is better left unsaid. If the assistant can walk into the courtroom representing the people of the state of Illinois, move to dismiss a case, or decide what is going to be put on in evidence or not put on in evidence, then he is acting as the state's attorney, and he is in a position where he's policy-making. In that case, and he has a right to. State's attorney also has the right to fire him if he doesn't like what he's doing, but that happens on a regular basis, too.
In order for the exemption to apply, Your Honor, they have to be on a policy-making level, and they have to be appointed by the elected official. I'd like to address that point because All assistant state's attorneys are not appointed by the elected official.
How do you get to be an assistant state's attorney without the state's attorney appointing you?
You apply, but...
Yeah, but who decides whether you're going to be hired?
Whomever the state's attorney uses to hire their associate.
No. Who is responsible for the decision to hire you?
Ultimately, the state's attorney.
You betcha.
But under the legislative history of the exemption, it clearly states that it has to be chosen by the state's attorney. In our situation with Christine Opp and Edward Barrett, they were not chosen by Richard Devine, who was the individual who terminated them. They were appointed assistant state's attorneys long before Richard Devine was ever elected.
He has to reappoint them. Go check.
Mr. Holman, let me ask from a different angle. Why don't the cases that we've decided in Levis against Petka and Americanos against Carter control this case?
Because they deal with political firing cases.
Well, Americanos also involved the ADEA and Title VII claims and drew exactly the same line.
And the test that they used and what we're suggesting it was improper is they're not looking at the specific powers of the individual.
So are you asking us to overrule Americanos?
I'm asking you to look at the individual powers of the positions held by our clients.
Which would require overruling Americanos.
I believe Americanos was ultimately ruled on the First Amendment, Your Honor.
If you take a look at the end of the opinion, you'll see that there are also Title VII and age discrimination claims in there that were dismissed on precisely the same grounds.
And the approach taken in that case was to look at the inherent authority or power that's vested in the employee as opposed to the actual
If you want to ask us to overrule it, you can do that.
I'd ask this court to overrule it because I don't think it's consistent with what the legislative history was on
it's
the
certainly
exemption.
Consistent with the text of the statute. We don't have to get into the legislative history.
No, because the language...
The statute just says an appointee on the policymaking level.
And who is an appointee? And what is a policymaking level? Those are two terms that we have to look into further. And to just take the position of assistant state's attorney, someone who is their first year of law school, and say, you are now on a policymaking level, is the wrong result. And that's why we'd ask the court to reverse.
Ms. Diamond.
May it please the court.
Try not to talk me out of anything, will you?
Should I sit down now, perhaps, Your Honor? I can only say that, first of all, my name is Karen Diamond, and I represent the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, that the plaintiffs in this action urge this court to abandon its longstanding approach for determining if a position is a policymaking one. In both ADEA cases and Title VII cases and patronage cases, this court has always looked first at whether or not either statutes, ordinance, regulations, or other law define the parameters of the power and responsibility of that position. And if the law is clear as to what those powers and duties are of the position, no further factual analysis is required. And here in Illinois, the powers and duties of assistant state's attorney are quite broad and well-defined by Illinois case law. Instead, the plaintiffs would have this court conduct a factual determination seemingly in every case where a plaintiff claims that he or she is not a policymaker. And further, they would ask this court to look not at the position, but rather at the particular occupant of the position at the time that occupant was terminated from it. Both of these approaches are contrary to law and unworkable. In this case, all three plaintiffs claimed that they brought claims pursuant to the ADEA, and the state's attorney's office defended this action by saying that there are three exemptions from the definition of employee under the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. And those exemptions are for elected officials, personal staff, appointees on the policymaking level, and advisors as to constitutional or legal authority of the office holder. Now, it was only the third one of those exemptions that the state's attorney's office relied on, and I point that out because in their briefs, the plaintiffs argue that they did not fall within the personal staff of the state's attorney. I'd like to make it clear the state's attorney's office never argued that they did. And the cases that the plaintiffs rely on in that area of law, and that would be Ravine, Teneyuka, and Owen, simply are not applicable because they deal with a different exemption. The one we're looking at is appointee on the policymaking level. Counsel argues that the district court erred by using a broad interpretation. As Your Honor has pointed out, the term appointee on a policymaking level is not an ambiguous term, and there's no need to look at the legislative history. Nonetheless, even if this court were to examine whether or not the term should be interpreted in a broad or narrow fashion, it should note that the U.S. Supreme Court in Gregory versus Ashford actually took a broad look at this term. The court said that we will not read the ADEA to cover state judges unless Congress has made it clear that judges are included. So therefore, there is no indication that this court must apply a narrow interpretation to this phrase. So what are positions on a policymaking level? This court has used the same definition again and again. This question the court asked is whether the position, not whether the individual, but whether the position held by the individual authorizes either directly or indirectly meaningful input into government decision-making on issues where there's room for principal disagreement on goals or their implementation. I suggest to this court that the definition of the powers and duties of Illinois ASAs is so broad that it matches up and fits within that definition of a policyholder by law, and that no factual determination is necessary. As I've explained in my brief, the Illinois courts, since as early as 1915, have defined how broad the powers are of assistant state's attorney. These positions are created by law. They're in office rather than mere employment. They exercise some sovereign power of the state. ASAs are generally clothed with all the powers and privileges of the state's attorney, and all acts done by assistant state's attorney in that capacity must be regarded as done by the state's attorney himself or herself. And assistant state's attorney are essentially surrogates for the state's attorney. The Illinois Attorney General has also issued an opinion indicating that it's not really possible for the state's attorney to limit the power and authority of his assistants, that each one of those assistants inherently has policymaking power. Illinois courts have consistently ruled, and this court has too. This court, in several cases, addressed the powers of Illinois ASAs. One would be in Livis versus Petra, where the court held in a patronage case that Illinois assistant state's attorney each have policy-making power and therefore cannot bring such an action. In McGrath versus Gillis, this court also described Illinois ASAs as being surrogates for the state's attorney. And finally, in Americanus, more recently, this court was actually looking at Indiana deputy attorney generals, but nevertheless used the same analysis and looked at Indiana law to determine that the powers and duties of Indiana deputy attorney generals were so broad that they were automatically policymakers. And therefore, the position of assistant state's attorney is a policymaking one. As I mentioned, the plaintiffs in this case urged this court to look at what they were actually doing at the time of their termination as opposed to the powers inherent in their position. And that approach is incorrect. In fact, plaintiffs cite no case where a court has held that that is the proper approach in these types of actions. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has stated in Gregory versus Ashcourt that the ADEA exempts appointees on the policymaking, not appointees who happen to make policy. Americanos versus Carter, this court decided that, or rather noted with approval, that the lower court looked just at the powers set forth by statute and given to the deputy attorney generals and didn't conduct a factual inquiry. And the court said that that was proper. By contrast, in the Tomczyk versus City of Chicago case, this court criticized the lower court when it did begin to conduct a factual inquiry regarding a position that had a duty set forth by statute or regulation. In fact, the court said that even if an individual performs fewer or less important functions than others in the position, he will still be exempt if the position inherently encompasses tasks that are on the policymaking level. I think it's also important to conclude that this type of determination can be made as a matter of law. There is no question of fact here. There are a number of cases which I have cited, Your Honors, where either the statute, the ordinance, regulation, or case law has dictated that the policy or that the position is a policy-making one. And those include Livis, Americanus, Vargas, Pleva versus Norquist involving a zoning board member, Heck versus the City of Freeport, including involving an inspector general, Klein, deputy auditor, and so forth. By contrast, there are other cases where this court has found that there simply are no statutory or regulatory positions which define the position. And in those cases, the court must conduct a factual investigation. And those would include, for instance, Coleman versus Sheehan involving deputies, Hernandez involving state's attorney's office support members, Riley versus Blagojevich involving an assistant warden, and so forth. I'd like to mention one case in particular, and that's the Dineen case, which I think creates an interesting illustration of this concept. In that case, it was a district court case. The plaintiff applied to be the fire chief. He was an assistant fire chief. And in dismissing his claim under Title VII for denial of the promotion, Judge Bucklow said that this position, the fire chief position, was one which had positions, had duties outlined by statute. And therefore, it was clearly a policymaking position, and that claim could be dismissed automatically. But in terms of Dineen's claim that he was improperly terminated from his position as an assistant fire chief, Judge Bucklow found she did have to do a factual determination because that position had no statutory powers and had no clear duties set forth by law. So I think it illustrates the difference in those types of situations. With respect to their request that this court overturn its clearly established body of law regarding whether or not assistant state's attorneys are policymakers, I would urge this court...
I would be against that.
Yeah.
Sound idea.
And I'd like to bring to your attention a couple of reasons why that is so.
Don't have to.
All right, I won't do that. But I think if this court looks at Tomczak, it will see some of the reasons why this court should do so. Finally, Your Honor, I would like to say that this court also should decide that all assistant state's attorneys are appointed by the state's attorney as a matter of law. That is, the elected office holder is actually the person appointing them. While this court has not had occasion to address this particular issue in the past, Judge Bucklow did in the case of Burvid versus Alvarez, and she came to the conclusion that the Seventh Circuit and Illinois law compel the conclusion that plaintiff was both in a policymaking position and actually appointed by the state's attorney. In fact, Illinois law requires that all ASAs must be appointed by the state's attorney. If they're not appointed by the state's attorney, they're not actually assistant state's attorneys. So therefore,
You're quoting me now. Go ahead.
Pardon?
You're quoting me, but go ahead.
Well, yes, Your Honor. In any event...
Why? I already know about it. So do they.
All right. In any event, Your Honor, I would like to say in conclusion that the defendants' appellees request that the court affirm the dismissal of each one of the plaintiff's complaints with prejudice. And unless there's any further questions, I will conclude. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. The time has expired. Our thanks to all counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. Thank you for that clarification. The case is taken under advisement.